Global bank regulators adopt blowout prevention rules.
But how well will they work?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, September 13th. The world's central banks have agreed to new rules designed to make the global financial system less risky.
Also today, the House Republican leader says he is open to letting taxes rise for the highest earners. And Oprah Winfrey starts her show's final season today. Will she take her economic impact with her? But first,
meeting in Basel, Switzerland, regulators agreed yesterday to force banks to triple the amount of capital reserves, spare cash they can use in a crisis. But the regulations will be phased in over the next decade. Matthew Bishop is the U.S. editor of The Economist magazine and author of the book The Road from Ruin. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Thank you. Will this prevent another crisis?
Well, the unfortunate answer is not necessarily. And in fact, it's not even clear that the rules would have prevented the last crisis. They're a simple idea, which is that the more risk a bank takes, the more it should have a big pile of money sitting on the side that it can use just in case things go worse than it's expected. But the trouble is figuring out how big that pile of money ought to be is extremely difficult, and the rules are very complicated. These rules aren't even going to be phased in, as you say, until 2023, and by that time, the banks may well have moved on and have a completely different business model for all we know.
It could be a very different financial world. So how does this fit, sir, into the American regulatory framework then?
Well, I think American banks have always had some requirement to keep money, capital aside in this way. This, if it's implemented in the way it's currently planned, will mean they have to keep a lot more money on one side, which means that they will lend less. Which probably won't be all that great for the economy. But the regulatory reforms that have gone through Washington, although I have a lot of questions about them, what they have cleared up is what happens, what the government can do when things do get into a horrible mess. Hank Paulson famously thought that he didn't have the legal powers to rescue Lehman Brothers. Well, now it's clear the government does have the power to rescue a bank like that. What Basel is about is trying to stop the mess happening, and I think that's a much, much harder question, and we haven't really got a solution to that problem.
Matthew Bishop, U.S. editor of The Economist magazine. Matthew, thanks.
Thank you.
White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said this morning he hopes a top Republican was serious about a compromise on cutting taxes. Over the weekend, the leader of House Republicans said he would support only a partial extension of expiring tax cuts. Here is Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Congress is trying to decide what to do about tax cuts enacted under the Bush administration, which expire on December 31st. President Obama only wants to extend the tax cuts for families making less than $250,000 a year. Yesterday on CBS, House Minority Leader John Boehner said he could support that.
If the only option I have is to vote for those at $250,000 and below, of course I'm going to do that. But I'm going to do everything I can to fight to make sure that we extend the current tax rates for all Americans.
Republicans say even the rich need lower taxes in these tough economic times. But the Obama administration says the government shouldn't add to the deficit by spending billions of dollars on a tax break for people with high incomes. It says more than 97% of taxpayers fall below the $250,000 threshold and would still get the tax cut. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
BlackBerry's cell phones may be facing the biggest challenge yet to their market dominance among business users. There are reports that JPMorgan Chase could soon allow its nearly 250,000 employees to start using iPhones and Android phones for official company messaging and email. And banking giant UBS may do the same. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
The BlackBerry has been the king of keyboard phones.
And along comes Apple and introduced touchscreen, and now everybody wants that because they want to do browsing and other functions.
Gartner Group's Ken Delaney says the BlackBerry is rushing to catch up. Consider its recent sales pitch.
Look at this. I just need to press the screen for a sec, and all my options are right there. Just look, press, and go. It's that simple.
Delaney says the iPhone and Google's Android smartphones are gaining the edge. Information technology departments favor the BlackBerry as more secure for business communications. But when everybody wants one, including the boss...
They force their IT people to start to support these things, even when they break their security models. So IT is really the tail of the dog here.
And Forrester analyst Ted Shadler says Apple has courted business customers by adding email and security features to its iPhone. Still, he says research in motion has always been innovative with its BlackBerry.
The door's never closed. If you come up with a great new product, a killer product, then people will buy it.
For now, though, Shadler says the BlackBerry needs to fight for a smaller share of the market. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, September 13th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects the United States. When Greece began slashing its budget and raising taxes to cover its deficit, the country's workers went on strike. They rioted in the streets of Athens. Well, that's not the sort of thing you'd expect to see in London, but as the UK grapples with budget cuts unions don't like, they're calling for widespread protests. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
The British government plans to cut $240 billion from its budget, but unions and workers don't think now's the right time to be doing it, and they want to call a national strike in protest. 30 years ago, dead bodies piled up in warehouses and rubbish lay uncollected on the streets when everyone from gravediggers to trash collectors went on strike to protest about pay freezes. Brendan Barber is the General Secretary of the TUC, which represents more than 6 million trade union members from all industries.
It's going to hit hardest the weakest and the most vulnerable in our society. We know those are going to be the consequences. Whatever the details, the scale of the cuts that are going to be made is going to do huge damage.
The unions are calling for joint industrial action, like in the 1970s, but government officials insist these cuts have to be made and blame their predecessors for leaving the country in such a mess. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer.
On a trade mission to China last weekend, California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger laid out a proposal for the Chinese to invest money into high-speed rail. The Golden State's $19 billion in the red, and the governor's looking for investments. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports the Chinese might be the best choice out there.
From Anchorage, Alaska to New York City, that's the length of China's high-speed rail network. It's the longest system in the world, and the country plans to double its size by 2020. John Scales is the World Bank's transport coordinator in China.
If China was able to take the knowledge and experience they have at building and developing a railway and effectively use that knowledge elsewhere, I think it would be beneficial to whatever country they were to work with.
European and Japanese companies have traditionally dominated the $155 billion global market for building railways. Watch out for China. Chinese companies are building high-speed rail projects from Saudi Arabia to Turkey to Venezuela. Is California next? First, the cash-strapped state needs to come up with the money. Once that's in place, the Chinese will want to make sure they get a better reception than the last time they came to the U.S. to build railroads 150 years ago. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The Oprah Winfrey Show starts its final season today. For 25 years, the show has been taped in Chicago. Now that the talk show queen is ending her program, Chicago is starting to contemplate the idea of life without Oprah. Mm. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports.
There's no question Oprah has had a sustained economic impact on Chicago. There are the 400 people she employs at her production studio. There are her retail stores. There's all the tourism dollars her audience members spend. And, oh yeah, there's an entire neighborhood she helped revitalize. Ina Pinckney recalls what Chicago's West Loop area used to look like.
You would see all the hookers on Lake Street on Friday afternoon with the truckers coming by, and it was a very unpleasant place to be.
Pinckney runs a restaurant just down the block from Oprah's studios.
The thing that has helped the most was Oprah. When Oprah came to this neighborhood, she really stabilized the neighborhood.
The West Loop is now home to dozens of Chicago's hippest clubs, restaurants, and art galleries. Oprah opened her studios there in 1990. No study's ever been done on her precise economic impact, but University of Chicago economist Charlie Whelan says that the annual amount is easily in the millions.
at bottom, the most significant thing that Oprah did was to produce a show that people wanted to watch more than they wanted to do anything else for that hour that it was on. So at the end of the day, that's the supreme accomplishment here, and she did it for decades. That's an enormous economic value.
Oprah and the show have also been a source of free marketing for Chicago. Her final episode isn't until May, but Whelan says even without the show, Oprah's Harpo Studios can still be a regional hub for film and video production.
One would hope that it actually would continue to have a relatively positive effect, that if you were in the Midwest and you were looking for a place where you needed to produce television, you needed to produce documentaries, you needed to cut film, that the existence of Harpo would be a reason that you would come and do it in Chicago.
Still, a Harpo spokeswoman says not all 400 employees will be kept on staff once the show ends, but details aren't yet available. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold for Marketplace.
It's Fashion Week in New York City, and later today, Donna Karan and Perry Ellis will introduce new collections, and eco-friendly designers will kick off their own fashion show. So we asked Marketplace's Adrian Hill from our sustainability desk to talk a little bit about fashion that's better for the environment. She's with us now in the studio. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning.
So help me out here. What is sustainable fashion?
Well, it's a lot of things depending on who's defining it. Everything from clothes made from organic cotton and natural dyes to clothes made from fair trade fabric and the ultimate in environmental friendliness, vintage or hand-me-downs. Some of it's really good for the environment and the people who make the clothes, and a lot of it's just greenwashing.
And what's the market for this type of clothing?
Well, more and more products and fashion lines calling themselves eco-friendly and sustainable are putting products out there. So designers and producers seem to think the interest is there. Companies are lining up big name stars like Emma Watson to help push the lines. But the real question is whether or not people are going to buy them.
And will they?
That's tough to say. Yeah. I talked to an analyst who told me that consumers are interested in eco-friendly and socially responsible clothing, but they really don't want to pay much of a premium for them. And that'll be tough, considering how cheap the clothes we buy at Target and H&M are. It can be more expensive to make eco-socially friendly garments if you're paying people a fair trade wage or using cotton that costs more to grow. And in other cases, retailers might just be jacking up the prices because they think they can get away with it. I did find a study that said retail sales of clothing and home products made from organic cotton was up to over $4 billion last year, which is a 35% jump from the year prior.
You know, Adrian, I don't want to sound totally like a jerk here, but are any of these clothes, I mean, actually good looking? Do they look like, you know, I don't know. I think of like burlap or something like that, that there's got to be some sort of eco-fashion look.
With tree bark from all that tree hugging. Like,
yeah,
clinging
exactly.
On it. Yeah. No, some of them I think are pretty fashionable. It's not just T-shirts and jeans or burlap that you... Though the stereotype is a hurdle for the industry, but I'll let you judge for yourself. I put up a slideshow on our website, marketplace.org.
All right, we'll go there and check it out. Marketplace's Adrian Hill joining us here in the studio. Adrian, thanks.
Thank you.
And finally, Americans are less informed than ever, right?
Not so much, Bill. Actually, a new survey from the Pew Research Center finds we spend just as much time getting the news from television, radio, and newspapers as we did a decade ago, 57 minutes a day.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we spend another 13 minutes a day getting news online.
Aha. So thanks to the internet, we are actually more likely than ever to be informed
yes.
about such issues as Justin Bieber's big win last night at the MTV Video Music Awards. Well, I'm certainly informed about his being dreamy.
Oh, he is.
I know about that because of the internet. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
Baby.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.